are listening to Adaptivate, a podcast that inspires industry leaders to leverage technology and new ideas to learn how to adapt, grow their businesses, and create better organizations. My name is Jeremy Miller, and I'm a marketer that currently works at GE Appliances, and I consider myself a student of business and innovation. I am talking with technologists, engineers, and business leaders about how their experiences have shaped their mindsets. In today's episode, we will be speaking with Taylor Marr, lead economist at Redfin, a real estate brokerage technology company. At Redfin, Taylor is responsible for leading the research team that analyzes data from their platform and industry to understand trends and identify opportunities. Taylor holds a bachelor's in economics and psychology from the University of South Dakota and a master's degree in international development economics from the University of Applied Sciences in Berlin. Taylor, you know, thanks for being here today and being on the podcast. I'm really excited to have you. You know, we met a couple of years ago at the Tech Home Builder Summit, and I thought you gave a really great presentation on some of the things that Redfin was seeing relative to the industry. But I actually thought it'd be really cool if maybe first you actually talked a little bit about how you got into economics, and then maybe a little bit about how a company like Redfin uses somebody like yourself with a background in economics. Yeah, I think that's actually a relatively new concept for a lot of private companies outside the insurance and finance sectors.
Sure. Yeah. And thank you so much for having me on the show, Jeremy. So I got into economics back in undergrad. I was studying psychology, really interested in human behavior. I thought of psychology as really trying to understand decision making and personal choices. I took an economics class and saw that this was sort of a way of looking at aggregate human behavior of when a lot of people make similar choices. What do you see? And that's how we think about markets or think about aggregate choices that affect the economy. And so I was really fascinated with thinking about that through the lens of decision making. And I got increasingly interested in data and data analysis. So right out of undergraduate school, I worked as a data analyst at a tech company and really started to look at this idea of just analyzing big data. And I think that's been true for a lot of economics. It's increasingly gotten into big data analysis, where the role of a data scientist looks very similar to the role of an economist. But I went back to grad school for international economics to try and think more about how the global economy functions and what are the relationships between these different things and how might I apply the tools of data analysis to some of these broader questions about markets. And so after grad school, I was actually working in research and finance, and it was all great working in financial markets and doing data analysis. But oftentimes there was less creativity in that role with how to apply some of the skills of data science. So in my current role, about 5 years ago, I started working for Redfin as an economist. I actually started off as a data scientist, economist hybrid. And it really speaks to, I guess, my role as an economist in a tech company that's doing a lot of data science-y type of things with big data. And in this era of big data, it's really pairing the two skill sets of one, doing data analysis and knowing how to analyze, look at trends, what's happening, but also think through, going back to what I initially said, thinking through human behavior and what can we see in the data for how people are making choices right now that, you know, how those choices pertain to housing and the housing market, but also how do people respond to things like incentives or policies or opportunities? And so that's, I think, a big way that I really got into economics is really thinking through how might I kind of pair data with understanding decision making and human behavior.
Feels to me like you're becoming so much more intelligent about decision making in general and that whole process, but the psychology of it, as well as the impact it can have on your business and, you know, maybe even how you actually function day to day. In terms of just how you apply your roles and skills to Redfin, what are you driving in terms of insights and business value?
At Redfin, I manage the research team, which means we have, Redfin is a real estate that also has a great website and has its entire business built on all of the broader housing market data, what's listed for sale, what's happening. And we can see all of the data for most of the United States and parts of Canada with every home that's listed for sale, every home that sells. And we can look at this data to see what's happening in the broader market, what trends are emerging. And what I've been able to do at the research team is really make sense of some of these broader trends with how people are moving, migrating, relocating across the country, what's happening with the new home market versus existing homes, what are the new supply that's coming on. And so in working with this data, we can tell great stories out of what's been happening in the U.S. of how are people responding to the pandemic? Where are they moving to? Or maybe how has the market been reacting with building new homes throughout this time of really short supply? How that pertains to Redfin as a business, though, has been, I'm not just looking at what's happening with Redfin's business, but I can kind of look at what's happening in the broader market and inform where are there big opportunities that maybe Redfin can expand into. So I think there's definitely a lot of ways that we can use the data that a lot of tech companies are sort of sitting on this data, and the skills of an economist can look at and kind of do what I said before, look at aggregate behavior and how might we want to find opportunities in that behavior. For example, if a lot of people are buying new homes in a certain market, we might need to hire agents in that market to capture that new demand, or find partnerships to work with home builders who are building a bunch of new homes and how we might show those homes on Redfin. So those are a lot of different trends that might emerge from the insights that I see in the data, in the stories, as I'm looking at aggregate behavior across the U.S. And what Redfin might want to do to respond to those.
You know, it must be such an exciting time for someone like yourself as an economist, just because one, you have access to this data, and two, there's so much happening in the market. And so that was kind of the next question, which is, you know, obviously our customers, you know, they're builders as well, and everybody's hearing in the news that there's this huge migration from urban areas, cities to the suburbs. What are you seeing? Is that a reality? Do you think that's a permanent kind of migration? Like, what's kind of in your crystal ball?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. The one on a lot of people's minds. Going back to your first point, I do think it's these types of questions that we all kind of wonder about. Not just someone as an economist researching housing, but really these are the type of questions that everyone's kind of wondering. Hey, I have friends that are moving from Seattle to Nashville. Are a lot of people doing that? It feels like everyone I know is moving out to the suburbs. So I think these are almost the dinner party conversations, which make my job a lot of fun, is I just kind of follow the curiosity, or maybe my wife and I are having a discussion and I'm like, you know, I could probably look at the data and figure out if that's true, or if that's true across the country. First off, that's the fun part about being an economist in a tech company and having all this data, is just following the curiosity. I have a million questions, and it's fun to be able to rapidly look at the data and see if it matches up with our intuition, or if we get completely different results. And that sometimes happens as well. With regards to what's happening with migration or suburbanization, how the pandemic is really disrupting the city, that has been a key topic this year that a lot of people have wondered about. The evidence has been, at least halfway through the year, was fairly mixed, where you could look at it from some angles and see, oh, there is a trend. Other angles, there's not a trend. I think the longer we get into this, the clearer the data will be showing whether or not this is truly a trend. So what I'm seeing in the latest data, which is as of last week, I'm seeing that home price appreciation, so looking at how much home values have grown, has really pivoted. So in the most urban neighborhoods across the country, so you think of the downtown core where there's a lot of condos, home price appreciation last year was about 3%. That's slowed down to about 1%. In some cases, it's actually gone negative, such as San Francisco and or Seattle also, I think, would be included in that, where they've seen an actual decline in home values in certain neighborhoods for condos, especially. Whereas if we go to the least urban neighborhoods, we're talking rural areas and suburbs far out from the city, they've seen an acceleration of home price appreciation go from about 3% last year to more than 6% now this year. So there has been what I call a flattening of the curve. Anyone who studies urban economics knows that as you get further from the city center, you get cheaper prices per square foot. That kind of makes sense. There's a premium you have to pay to live close to work, so you pay more per square foot. And appreciation, historically, there's been a big urban revival throughout the earlier part of the decade. So home prices actually accelerated much faster in the most urban places during the first half of the decade. A lot of job growth was in the city. A lot of people were flocking to the city, millennials who were delaying having kids, and so they can afford cheap, you know, one bedroom apartment or condo. And so we saw greater demand in the urban core of most cities early on in the decade. But then as millennials have really entered into the demographic of having kids, starting families, looking to buy their first home, suburbanization has really started to pick up speed. So suburbanization was already a trend before the pandemic. What I am seeing is that the pandemic seems to be accelerating suburbanization a little bit more. This is most pronounced in New York City and San Francisco Bay areas, where if you look at those two cities in particular, you just see a massive shift of home buying activity from the city to the suburbs. Everywhere else, it's a little bit mixed, but mostly because those a lot of other cities are already somewhat suburban. So that's the first thing is suburbanization. We are seeing indeed a pivot of demands towards the suburbs or further out away from the urban core. Whether or not that will be sustained, I think, is a little unclear because eventually we'll open back up. Offices will start to open back up and people will want to come back to the city. But if before people commuted 5 days a week, a lot of people are planning to maybe only commute 2 or 3 days a week back into the office and then to do a hybrid work remote situation. And that means that, let's say before you were commuting 5 days a week at 30 minutes each way, which that's about an average American commute. Now you plan to only work 3 days a week, you could commute 50 minutes and have the same weekly driving time. But with that extra driving time, you can purchase almost double the size of home in most American cities for the exact same price. So by living further away from the city center, having a 50-minute commute instead of a 30-minute commute, but only doing it 3 days a week instead of five, you're commuting about the same, but you actually can purchase a lot more homes. So that's kind of the economic intuition of the behavior of why that might be happening even after the offices start to open back up. But otherwise, we have seen an uptick in cross-county or cross-metro migration. So people are relocating to markets where you can buy more housing and work remote. A lot of people, just as suburbanization is most pronounced in the Bay Area and New York City, that's also true of an uptick or an acceleration of out-migration. The Bay Area and New York City have both seen a pretty sizable increase in people looking to flee those markets and move predominantly into markets that were already attracting lots of new residents due to migration, such as Texas, Arizona, Tennessee, Florida. These are all markets that typically offer affordable housing, lower tax burdens, sunny weather. So that's definitely another trend that we're seeing is an acceleration of these migration patterns. Now, Arizona and Texas, these are places that already were attracting hundreds of thousands of residents who were relocating before the pandemic. But we are seeing an acceleration of that pre-existing trend, at least this year. So yeah, those are kind of the two big trends. Pretty much no matter what data you're looking at with regards to the U.S. housing market, you can start to see glimpses of this, of both of these trends out of the Bay Area and out of New York City show up in the data. So some of the most competitive places, competitive housing markets, are the counties on the edge of both of these metros where a lot of people have left, such as into Sacramento or into Connecticut. So that's kind of what I'm seeing in the data. It's been really fun to look at it and have a debate about, you know, how long is this going to last? Is it early retirement? Is it millennials starting a new home? Or are people buying second homes? That's also been one of the drivers of some of these relocations we've been seeing as people have maybe been relocating to Florida. Second home mortgage purchases have really doubled more than what they were a year ago. And that indicates that there is a shift of people looking to sort of hide out maybe this year in a vacation home, especially the wealthy who have been well off throughout the pandemic. But that those second home purchases have really highlighted some of the places such as seasonal towns that have also attracted a lot of people fleeing and maybe just working remote for the time being. And perhaps they'll Airbnb it out in the future. But that's definitely been also kind of one point that we've been looking at for that.
When we return, Taylor will talk about the future of data and some tools that you can use to start to learn how you could spot trends in your industries.
You know, being from the Bay Area, you know, I got the sense a lot of people were looking to get out. They just didn't have a reason to. So I was not surprised when, the word flee, you know, kind of feels like appropriate. Mm-hmm. I want to get your perspective on the future of data. And I know that's kind of a broad question. And I guess what I mean by what do you think the future of data is? It seems like that data is now in everybody's hands. Yeah, we all have access to some data, some companies more than others. What do you think the kind of the real future for business and data and folks like yourself looks like?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we've heard it remarked many times that data is the new oil, that really the more data companies have, the wealthier that asset, the data asset is, or the more valuable it is, I should say. It's the tech companies that have really built their business on gathering data and then using that data to whatever ends they can to profit off that data. And that has been very successful because data is very cheap to own and to use compared to maybe traditional capital that companies have had to have. So data is a very valuable asset in that way. It's a very profitable one. I think what has given a lot of these tech companies the edge early on that really allowed them to be very successful is increasingly democratized and in the hands of more and more companies. So partly still at the mercy of the Googles or the Facebooks when you're doing marketing or looking at analytics, but also it's increasingly easier for business or even just anyone who's curious to gather data and to analyze it and to put it to use for their own needs. And so that's made it not just a competitive edge, but more of a prerequisite to really survive as a business. So I think that's kind of the state of the new data is it's becoming a language that people need to learn and become fluent in order to understand how to navigate business and grow their business or look for new opportunities. Oftentimes when I'm looking at the data, it's just looking at how demand is changing in certain areas or what's the outlook for housing. Are a lot of people going to be interested in moving to Seattle for the next few years? Should we build new housing here or should we open up a new business in this area? And thankfully, there's a lot of online tools that make asking those questions quite easy, still using the data. So even if someone's not doing the actual raw data analysis that I might do, there's a lot of easy services now to sort of ask those questions and find the answers they need. So I think it's kind of like speaking a new language. People are learning the language, learning how to interpret statistics and find the data sources that might be most valuable. There's obviously also a big risk for lying with data or for being misled by data. And there's a need to sharpen your eyes to basically find out or spot any of these lies or misleading claims. And that's true, especially if your business and your competitor makes a claim. You wonder, well, how did they do that analysis? Is that actually true? Are there other ways to ask that same question? And that's something that even a business needs to think about when they're trying to talk to their customers about why they might actually be just as competitive as the next guy, despite that marketing claim. So that's, I think, why data is almost a prerequisite or essential component of just doing business in the 21st century.
It's funny, the other day, actually, one of my favorite phrases, I don't know who said it, maybe you know who we can attribute it to, but you know, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. Before we go, you made me think of a time I was on a panel for a bunch of e-commerce leaders in digital marketing. And I asked the room, raise your hand if you work with data. Everybody raised their hand. And then I asked, raise your hand if you were trained to work with data. And maybe one person in a room of several hundred raised their hand, one or two, right? What advice would you give somebody who is starting to work with data or maybe is already starting to work with data, but doesn't necessarily have the background you have? You know, if you were to give somebody a place to maybe go start, can you think of something that might be helpful?
Yeah, I think the first place to start with a lot of people when they're trying to how to better understand data. So just as if you're trying to learn a new language, understand the key terms and concepts related to statistics or data analysis. So a simple book called Naked Statistics is an easy one that really breaks down how people look at questions, hard questions with data. It explains difficult concepts in really layman's terms. And I recommend finding books like that are really easy to read or intuitive, where what's most important is that you understand the concepts of what is being portrayed in the data or the data analysis. Now, the second thing is the actual tools to work with data. And that's where I recommend just downloading data that would be really interesting to you And the most interesting data set to you might really drive your curiosity to learn how to ask questions of the data. So as we're in a pandemic, a lot of people might wonder about where coronavirus cases are most rampant in the country. And so you can download data from Our World in Data, or the New York Times has some public data sets on the coronavirus in particular that's available. Downloading data that you find most interesting to you into Excel to play around with, or open it up into a tool. I use Tableau. It's really easy to play around with data in and, you know, show me the trend over time or make some simple averages by these different characteristics. The more that you just simply play around with data, asking questions that you're interested in, the quicker you'll be able to see how easy it is and how fun it is too to start to learn. And then you'll see certain things that you need to look up and better understand. But really, that's coming out of a necessity from trying to deeper understand what you're already interested in. So that's definitely what I recommend, is just playing around with data and developing a bit of a vocabulary around some of these concepts.
Thank you so much, Taylor. This was awesome. Tons of fun. I love talking about this sort of stuff. So I really do appreciate you coming on and being on the show.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, please subscribe on your favorite podcasting channels and always stay up to date on the latest episodes of Adaptivate.